From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United Nations General Assembly began its 74th session on Monday, September 23rd, just days after climate protests broke records. The meeting, taking place at the UN headquarters in New York City, is expected to go until September 30th. Eclipsed by both the climate protests and the controversy over President Trump soliciting Ukraine for political dirt this week, were a number of critical developments that flew under the radar. The U.S. worked to rally nations to side against Iran after a major airstrike on Saudi Arabia's oil fields. A potential step toward peace in Syria was discussed on the sidelines of the UN meeting. Turkey lobbied for refugee rights, and Egypt faced growing protests at home while President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi avoided the topic altogether. We turn to Khoury Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the program, Khoury.
Thank you, Sonali. So glad to be here.
Let's start with Iran. Before the impeachment inquiry and the Ukraine scandal hit newsstands this week, the big story was allegations that Iran, or at least Iranian-backed Houthi rebels, with Iran's help, had hit Saudi Arabia's oil field, critically curtailing its ability to produce oil for months. The U.S. claimed it had evidence that Iran did it. And of course, everybody started beating the drums of war. What was President Trump's goal at the United Nations this week? What did he actually accomplish? Because Hassan Rouhani, the Iranian president, was also speaking at the U.N.
Right. Well, the goal has been really to isolate Iran. And this is really just the latest step in what's been a very scary series of events that are escalating tensions. And it's really the United States. It's been, of course, deploying troops to the region, stationing an aircraft carrier off the coast of Iran, which remains there. It's been there for months. Folks will remember that fairly recently this summer, Trump came, according to by his own admission, within 10 minutes of an airstrike against Iran. And so the U.S. has been working to cast Iran as the sponsor of world terrorism. It's been working to isolate Iran. And of course, it maintains this punishing sanctions regime. And so Trump wanted to continue with that at the U.N. to promote this notion that Iran is the force in the Middle East that is creating all these hostilities. And I have to say that, you know, it was Iran actually that said, well, we refuse to meet with Trump until he lifts the sanctions. Trump said that he, going into the set of meetings at the UN, Trump said that he was willing to meet with Iran. It was Iran who said that they wouldn't meet with Trump, which is really quite striking when you think about the president of the United States being rebuffed, essentially. You know, Trump, on one hand, Iran, the sanctions remain. And of course, Iran wants the sanctions lifted. But the United States also didn't get what it wanted either. Iran has not bowed down.
And Iran's goal at the UN was to lobby to lift those sanctions that it says have crippled its economy, right? And in fact, as you and I are speaking, I'm now seeing that Rouhani claimed that the U.S. offered to remove all sanctions on Iran in exchange for negotiations. Trump has retorted that he absolutely did not do that. The State Department said it was a baseless report. So there's this sort of ongoing push and pull between Iran and the U.S. about who wants to meet with whom, who said what. Overall, though, it seems as though Trump is reluctant to jump into war. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. In this situation where Iran says one thing and the Trump administration says another thing, it's something that we've actually seen throughout Trump's presidency, where the White House makes one claim that is then disputed by foreign governments. And so we don't know exactly what happened. But I think the big thing, when we think about the various efforts that have been waged by the United States and its allies, particularly Saudi Arabia, in the region, whether it has been, again, this punishing sanctions regime to kind of get Iran to bend to the U.S.'s will, whether it has been this catastrophic war that Saudi Arabia has carried out against Yemen with the U.S. helping really so much that it's essentially a U.S.-Saudi war. And And yet here we are. These things not only have been devastating to the populations of Iran and devastating to the population of Yemen and populations throughout the region, but they actually also haven't worked in terms of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia throwing their weight around to try to get what they want.
And I want to get to Yemen in just a moment because there's been a development on that too. But on this issue of the U.S. potentially going to war, we're talking about another country, a U.S. ally, being hit by Iran, which the war hawks feel is good enough reason to launch a war. Traditionally, one goes to war when one's own country has been hit, or maybe military installations in another part of the world. But it wasn't the US or US military installations hit. It was Saudi Arabia that was hit. And Trump, of course, made his initial Twitter response was to take direction from the Saudis as to whether the US would respond militarily. He came under a lot of flack for that. Was there any sense that you got just this week that Trump is hoping to continue the standard status quo with Iran, which is c keep pressure through sanctions and isolate Iran and not do much more? Or, in other words, I should say, did he actually succeed in winning over any allies at the UN to join him on this strategy on Iran?
Right. I think the first thing to say is on one hand, of course, the US has been extremely threatening toward Iran. Trump has threatened to annihilate Iran. As you said earlier, Trump has come close to bombing Iran. He's stationed troops in, surrounding Iran. And so there have been these very grave military threats, all while maintaining this brutal sanctions regime. And yet the actual decision to, the strategic decision on the part of the US to militarily attack Iran, it seems that there's not quite clarity or unity on that. As we know, the biggest proponent of attacking Iran was John Bolton. He was recently essentially let go from the Trump administration. And so one way to interpret this is that Trump is hoping that by surrounding Iran with troops and with weapons, by threatening to attack Iran, by maintaining this sanctions regime, that Iran's going to bend to the US's will. And that has not happened. So if the question is, has Trump succeeded? He has not succeeded in terms of getting Iran to acquiesce. And at the same time, even though the US hasn't actually carried out a military attack on Iran, we have to be clear that, I mean, the US, as you pointed to, in its relationship with Saudi Arabia, the US has announced that it was going to deploy more missiles to Saudi Arabia, supposedly in defense of that country against Iran. So it's the United States that's actually escalating the conflict by further militarizing what is already a heavily militarized region.
As far as you know, have the Europeans given up on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal that Trump pulled out of and that essentially sparked this series of events that we're at now?
Right. As far as I know, I don't know if they've given up on that. But again, it seems that there's a bit of a stalemate here, actually.
Let's talk about, I mentioned Yemen. There was, because Saudi Arabia with US backing has been hitting Yemen, and Yemen figures in all of this because it was the Houthi rebels in Yemen that immediately, initially, took credit for the attacks, the air attacks that took out Saudi Arabia's oil production. We just heard that the Houthi rebels, just days ago, unilaterally announced a ceasefire, which was surprising, and that has led to Saudi Arabia saying that it will have a partial ceasefire. What does this mean? This is a war that's been going on for a long time. It's been so destructive. Is this a glimmer of hope for peace?
It's a good question, and I will say that I'm hesitant because there have been ceasefires over the course of this conflict, so I think we will see. It's worth noting, just for context, that the same it, with it just within days of the attack on the Saudi oil facilities, there were these two, one after the other, airstrikes carried out by Saudi Arabia in Yemen. One of which targeted a mosque and the other of which targeted a house. They killed 22 civilians and wounded many more. And that has received virtually no attention from the mainstream media and even less attention from government officials around the world. Contrast that with the attention that's gone to the attack on the Saudi oil facilities. And I think we see the kind of the way that the powerful in the world view Yemeni life. So that's the context here. On one hand, Saudi Arabia and the United States supporting it have shown that they are really willing to do anything in terms of kind of using violence to try to get their will. And yet, it has not worked. I mean, this war continues. Evidently, Saudi Arabia remains vulnerable militarily, despite all of the targeting of hospitals, the school buses, the houses, the mosques, et cetera. And so on one hand, this has been an absolute catastrophe. And on the other hand, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. have also failed to get what they want out of it.
Let's talk about the other war in that area. Well, there are several. And that's Syria. There has been an exodus of refugees, and Turkey at the United Nations has cast itself as a defender of Syrian refugees. And I'm wondering if you think that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's performance, if you will, at the UN was sincere in wanting Syrian refugees protected, or is Erdogan using Syrian refugees as political pawns? He has, in recent weeks, announced massive resettlement of refugees from Turkey back into the border areas between Turkey and Syria. And Turkey is the largest recipient of Syrian refugees. What do you make of what Turkey did at the UN?
Yeah, it's an important question. I think that Erdogan's speech was absolutely cynical. I mean, and I do think that he's trying to posture on the world stage as a defender of refugees. He's doing this not only with Syrians, but he does this with Palestine as well. It's in the same UN speech, he kind of postured against the Israeli violence in Palestine. And at the same time, domestically in Turkey, it's been a nightmare, actually, for Syrian refugees. Syrian refugees in Turkey have not been welcomed with open arms. They have been restricted legally in terms of where they're allowed to live in Turkey. They're restricted in terms of whether or not they're allowed to work. And life has been essentially made impossible for them. And actually, this past summer, Turkey carried out massive raids in the cities of Turkey, rounding up Syrian refugees and deporting them, in some cases driving them to Idlib, which, of course, has been subject to bombing from Russia and from the government. So these are the very places that refugees fled from. So I think it's absolutely cynical. And, you know, Erdogan, unfortunately, as with so many governments, so many heads of state that spoke at the UN have been carrying out horrific policies toward refugees, actually.
So we also have, you mentioned Israel. Israel is a big player in all of this. As the UN meeting was taking place, there has been a political scramble within Israel to try to cobble together government after elections resulted in incumbent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party not winning enough seats in the Knesset to cement his continuation of his leadership. There's been developments within Israel, but hasn't Israel been one of the main proponents of, going back to the situation in Iran, the main proponents of U.S. actions against Iran? Did Israel, and I believe it was the foreign minister who was present at the United Nations because Netanyahu couldn't be there, did Israel play any role at the UN beyond its usual let's isolate Iran policy?
Yeah, I don't think it played any role that we're not used to Israel playing. I do think it's important, as you're saying, Israel has really been one of the leaders, along with the United States and, of course, Saudi Arabia, in terms of stoking the flames against Iran and claiming that Iran is the number one sponsor of world terrorism. And this is not only geopolitical in terms of trying to isolate Iran and really, again, get for the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel to get their way in the Middle East and really recast it in the way that they want to, where there's no challenge to their hegemony. It's also about what Netanyahu's agenda is domestically, where he has kind of hammered the Israeli population, saying that Iran is this huge threat and I am the only one who's tough enough to handle Iran.
And in past United Nations gatherings, he's held up maps and tried to make a case about why Iran should be attacked. Yeah.
Right, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just this kind of base warmongering and racism along the kind of the lines that we saw, particularly with this most recent Israeli election. And so, we will see what the actual outcome is in terms of a government in the Knesset. But what we do know is that the kind of anti-Palestinian racism, the racism against Black people and others who are within Israel as refugees, and then of course the kind of anti-Muslim and warmongering that Netanyahu's been stoking against Iran. This has by and large been taken up by the various other right-wing parties, which dominate the Israeli conversation at the moment. And so, whether or not, I mean, we know that Netanyahu has experienced a certain setback. He can no longer get whatever he wants. That's what this election showed. And yet, the many things that people around the world abhor about Netanyahu are going to be present in terms of the Israeli government, whether he, regardless of what happens with Netanyahu.
So let's turn to Egypt. Egypt is a very interesting case right now. You have a president who has essentially taken over as a new dictator after the ouster of Hosni Mubarak by the Arab Spring. And right as Abdel Fattah al-Sisi was at the United Nations, he was facing mass protests at home in Egypt. We've had hundreds, actually, I believe it's now 2,000 people arrested over just a week in Egypt. Fresh protests expected this weekend and into next week as well. What is happening in Egypt? And did Mr. Sisi refer to any of the problems he was facing back home?
Yeah, it's an important question. And, in 2011, the whole world was inspired by a wave of rebellion that kind of emerged in the Arab world and, of course, spread elsewhere, including to the United States with Occupy Wall Street, which also happened. But it was really Egypt that was the bright light shining in terms of the desire for revolutionary change. And the millions of Egyptians who sought to make that hope real. I mean, this was the largest revolution, I believe, in world history. And the power of that, really, the Egyptian state and its allies have worked to bury. And I think the Sisi regime has been absolutely ruthless in terms of its repression. And so the kind of defiance that we have seen in recent days on the streets and the cities of Egypt has been absolutely incredible. We know that they are rounding up all kinds of activists, both who advocate for freedom in Egypt and freedom elsewhere. For example, the head of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement in Egypt has been jailed since this summer, somebody who's advocating for justice in Palestine. And the list could go on in terms of journalists and activists and so on. And we know that people have died in custody of Egyptian authorities. And so it takes tremendous courage for Egyptians to be protesting. Sisi essentially has dismissed them and said, oh, there is no protest. And yet he returned to fresh protests. And it wasn't clear that there were big calls for protests on Friday after days throughout the week of protests. It wasn't clear if there would be mobilization. And yet this Friday, people have mobilized. They are in the streets. And so there's a renewed hope of struggle from below in Egypt.
And we'll certainly see if how Sisi reacts, because of course these very high levels of arrests are directly a response to the Arab Spring and likely his fear of a resurgence of the Arab Spring. If if the Egyptian population could oust Hosni Mubarak, they could certainly oust al-Sisi. Of course, Mubarak was in power for decades, and it would be a great tragedy if the Egyptians had to wait decades more before truly finding freedom. I want to actually go back to Saudi Arabia briefly, not the Yemen war or the Iran attack, but what had happened with the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. At the same time as the UN meeting was happening, you had Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. giving an interview about Jamal Khashoggi and admitting that that murder happened under my watch, quote unquote. This is really interesting, and I don't believe it has gotten enough scrutiny. Is that chapter over? It seems as though the U.S. never held Saudi Arabia accountable for what happened to Khashoggi.
Right. Well, that's the, I think the question of, that's the first thing that has to be said, is that Saudi Arabia never faced real consequences for the murder of Khashoggi. And the United States, of course, led the way in terms of there being no accountability for that political assassination. And so the question of whether the chapter is over, I think, really depends on whether or not the people of the Middle East, of the U.S. and the people of the world will fight so that there can be some accountability for this kind of what's been a war on journalists. I mean, you know, we're talking about, yeah, this horrific act carried out by Saudi Arabia. It's carried
and
out.
It's going to be the 1 year anniversary of his killing in early October, by the way. I believe it was October 2nd of last year that it happened.
Right. And so, I'm also just thinking about the context that we're talking about this in terms of a gathering at the UN, and these, you know, Trump gave his speech, which was just sort of
farce. Should we use that word?
what was the word?
Farce.
Oh yeah. But it was like, on one hand, yeah, it's farcical. And it's also, I mean, it's farcical that somebody could be at the United Nations, whose whole idea, the whole nature of the United Nations is international cooperation.
Right.
And Trump gives this hard nationalist speech where it's this wholehearted embrace of sovereignty and defending it through violence and border walls and repressing refugees, right? And I thought, this is so chilling. How can somebody what he's objectively doing is denouncing the whole reason for being of the United Nations. And yet, the other men who got up and spoke the same day, I thought, well, actually, this makes sense. And so to circle back to the question of the murder of journalists, I mean, we were talking about Turkey earlier. I mean, Turkey has led the way in terms of arresting journalists. We've seen all kinds of intimidation of journalists in Brazil, where you know, the head of state of Brazil, Bolsonaro, spoke right before Trump. And so there's this kind of global attack on journalists. And I think the question of whether or not Saudi Arabia will be held accountable for its actions, or, you know, any of these states will be held accountable for their actions, it really is going to depend on social movements, because we are seeing the institutions that claim to stand for democracy, chiefly the U.S. government, absolutely failing to offer any consequences for those kind of actions.
Well, I appreciate you framing the conversation with Trump's speech, which we didn't directly address. And yes, you're absolutely right. The theme of the speech was quite chilling. Speaking to an international body that's based on globalism and cooperation, Trump just drew a hard line. Well, Khoury, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us today. What's a good place for people to read your writings?
Sure. So I'm at the Institute for Policy Studies, and our website is ips-dc.org. And my writings and those of my colleagues are up there.
And that's ips-dc.org. Khoury, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Khoury Peterson-Smith is Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing some of the political stories in the Middle East that transpired at the UN this week. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.